The Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is Tony Bemis,
Mary Tomich,
and Tom Lawrence.
And this is episode 167.
Wow. Fresh Looks. I mean, not Wow. Wow isn't the name of it. It's Fresh Looks.
Wow, Fresh Looks.
Yeah, Fresh Looks. And what we'll be taking a fresh look at this week is a Linux distro.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Which one's that?
There's so many to choose from. Actually, this version or this distro is called Bunsen Labs Linux.
Ooh.
Sounds scientific and,
yes,
you know, laboratory-like. But it is actually, and I was unaware of it until I saw something on DistroWatch, so I dug a little further and I thought, boy, this warrants a review, a fresh look, because this is rising from the ashes of CrunchBang Linux. So anyway, but I'll go ahead and get started with the quote-unquote official review. But earlier this year, there was considerable gnashing of teeth as the CrunchBang Linux project announced that it was ending development. Many were disappointed that this super efficient distro based on rock solid Debian, just kidding, Tom, just joking. Debian Linux was going dark. But good distros tend not to stay dead for long, and such was the case with CrunchBang Linux. Three successor distros rose from the ashes. There was CrunchBang +++, CrunchBang Manara, and Bunsen, not Menorah now, not the little, you know, Jewish lights, but Manara. And Bunsen Labs Linux. Now, according to Wikipedia, Bunsen Labs Linux is the most direct successor to CrunchBang because as of late September 2015, I apologize for that. That was completely unplanned. CrunchBang's, luckily I won't be saying that name throughout this, so that risk will not happen again. But anyway, CrunchBang's domain name was redirecting to Bunsen Labs website at bunsenlabs.org. So I'll examine Bunsen Labs Linux today. So will the flame of CrunchBang burn bright in Bunsen Labs Linux, or will Bunsen Lab Linux burn the lab down and be a flame out? Let's find out.
Ooh.
All right, first the vitals. Of course, the name is Bunsen Labs Linux. The maintainer is Jens John, at least from some digging that I did, because it wasn't immediately obvious on the website, so I kind of had to do some sleuthing, and I found that. The distro's latest birthday, Bunsen Labs Linux 8.2. Now, this is a release candidate. I want to mention that little caveat. We're looking at a release candidate, and typically release candidates is how the final version is going to look, except for maybe little bugs or little fixes that they might want to put in place. But anyway, it's release candidate 1. It's also known as Hydrogen, and it was released on November 3rd, 2015. It's derived from Debian 8 Stable, and the kernel it uses, based on the version that I downloaded, is 3.16.0-4. And the review desktop is OpenBox. I downloaded the 32-bit ISO, but a 62-bit version is also available. The sizes are 879 and 845 megabytes, respectively. Bunsen Labs Linux is a hybrid ISO, so you can install it on a USB stick as well as a computer. Mm-hmm. I installed it on my testing laptop I call Bemis.
All right.
I got from Bemis Computer Hosting.
Yeah.
Your company. Yeah. Your company. All right. The live environment. Now, Bunsen Lab Linux, I think I should just call it BLL. BL2.
BL2.
BLT.
Bunsen.
Yeah. We'll do that. Okay. It starts with a grub menu with four options. I can go live, 686 PAE, live 686 PAE failsafe, or I can go to an install or a graphical install. Now, the first option, of course, I selected live because I wanted to just check it out without making any changes to my hard drive. So BL2 easily booted to a monochromatic desktop, numerous shades of gray. I didn't count them all, but there weren't 50 there. There's a single tint two. Well, you know, it's the first thing that crapped into my mind.
Yes.
What does that tell you? But anyway, are you guys familiar with the Tint 2 panel?
No.
Tint 2?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Well, I went and looked it up. There's a single panel at the bottom, and that's how this review was initially written. But I later found out when I was doing some digging that it's called Tint 2. It's available, in, I think, the Arch repository. It's used by this instance of OpenBox. But anyway, there's a single tint 2 panel that span the top of the desktop. On the right side of the desktop, a Conky widget displayed system info and a list of shortcut keys for everything from opening a run dialog box, which we all know is Alt+F2.
Yeah.
Volume control and shortcuts to open commonly used applications such as the media player, web browser, etc. And by the way, the S that you see on the right side of it really equates to the Windows key or the Linux key that I like, as I call it.
Super key.
Super. That's super, what it stands for.
Super key.
Tom, I'm glad you're here helping me out already. But anyway, the graphics driver that was installed was the i915, which worked perfectly. And then the wireless. Now, you know from previous reviews that I have a Broadcom chip, and sometimes it can be a little iffy.
They're a little picky.
Yes, but I was pleased to see that my wireless chipset was taken care of by BL2. All I needed to do was supply my wireless password, and I was on the inner tubes, so that was excellent. Now, the default apps for BL2... are as follows. I've got a browser. It's IceWeasel. The Office Suite. This is kind of interesting because Bunsen Labs, it did not appear to contain a complete suite in the live environment. What it had, it used LibreOffice Writer. It also used the GNUmeric mm-hmm. Spreadsheet and Google Docs. That's what it had in its office area. I went and checked all of the various menu categories.
So it just had links for Google Docs? That's interesting.
It took you to Google Docs, but it did have the numeric spreadsheet installed as well as LibreOffice Writer. So it was kind of a hybrid, if you will.
Yeah, a little bit of everything in there.
Uh-huh. And I suspect it was probably to keep that that DVD down to maybe a manageable level.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Some of the office suites are kind of big. Mm-hmm. They do a lot, so.
Mm-hmm. They do. There was no mail client installed, so I suspect it was expecting you then to use the web. And the file manager was Thunar, and the version that was on this this distro was 1.6.3. Now, because OpenBox is used as a desktop, accessing the application menu is as easy as right-clicking anywhere on the desktop. For someone like me who's accustomed to a launcher in a particular location, it took a wee bit of time to get used to this approach, but definitely no big deal at all. And Bunsen Labs Linux uses my favorite icon set, Faenza, which is based on Apple's. It's got kind of a rounded corner square look to them. So I was very surprised to see that, and I enjoyed it, even though it was kind of monochromatic. I was impressed with the clean, lean look of this desktop. Now, onto the install. I was expecting to see an install icon on the desktop, but didn't see it. So, nor was one listed in the applications listed in the launcher menu, so I ended up rebooting and then just selecting the graphical install. When the option was presented by Grub, period. Sorry about that. That was all part of one sentence. the standard questions followed, of course, keyboard, country, all of that type of thing. And Bunsen Labs, again, found my wireless chipset and prompted me to configure the network. This step took only a few seconds, and then onto the partitioning step, my favorite part. Unless you specify otherwise, the default file system is ext4, although many other options are available. For example, ButterFS, JFS, XFS, FAT16, FAT32. I decided to create a root partition, home partition, and some swap space, just kind of the standard setup. The process is not too difficult because it's a graphical tool, although you can opt to set up your partitions from the command line. I did not try that. I just went with the graphical tool and kind of played around with it a little bit, and it all got set up just fine. So once I passed through those steps, then I ended up creating my user and the other types of things that you do when you're installing an OS, installing Linux. And so then I ended up rebooting. I rebooted, and this is what got kind of interesting. I rebooted to a screen welcoming me personally, or at least my username. The screen is simply a front end to a post-install script to help configure the installation. It notes I will need my administrator pseudo password, which is, it's kind of nice. I mean, if you're not accustomed to that. You also have the options of running the script later by invoking it from the terminal. So they've got that information there. Now, there were 15 different little screens on the script covering 10 different areas that I went ahead and worked through. The first one was a warning about adding PPAs. I had to type I space understand in order to continue. So they wanted.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't check a box. I had to type I understand.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's something that you should be thinking, that you're adding a repository from a third party outside of it, mm-hmm. which may have implications. What mm-hmm. are they doing in that PPA? So you understand that this isn't our problem. Don't call us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Cause so many times you got a checkbox, you know, oh yeah, I understand that EULA, if it's, you know, using something that has a EULA like that. So you just zip past it, but you're signed over your firstborn. But here in this case, they really want you to take that step. So hopefully you'll think about it as you type, I understand next.
Yeah. Right. And the, a lot of people assume that if it's in the repositories, then, you know, then it's a vetted program mm-hmm. that's good and working. And a PPA is not a vetted, that's exactly, it's personal, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it personal?
I see that as a future attack mm-hmm. vector as well. You know, some popular program, they changed the PPA. It's outside of the normal universe from Ubuntu or Debian or any of these other distributions. Mm-hmm. And they put something horrible in there. And everyone that's just used to using it didn't see it coming. So I think that could be a scary attack vector. So you do have to think about that when you're running, especially production machines that have a lot of valuable information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yep. And so once I did that and moved to the next screen, then there was a... Then it was asking me for permission, for the script to this is the, you know, the welcome script to execute apt-get update. So it sounded good to me. I went ahead and said, yep, go ahead and do it. And then, the next one was the permission for the script to execute apt-get upgrade. So, you know, again, it just kind of was working its way through here. Then, that was followed by whether or not I wanted to add the multimedia repository, which, of course I did. So I went ahead and did that. And, that was added. That was then followed by printer support. So, you know, basically whether I want to add printer support, cups, and other related utilities, so that I can then use printers. And I said yes. Then, install Java support. Now, some people will skip this, but I have to confess, I installed it.
I have it on mine too.
Yeah, I just to, you know, kind of walk through this thing and see.
I actually need it, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then the next step was kind of interesting because it asked me if I wanted to install LibreOffice, the whole suite. Because you recall from earlier, it only had LibreOffice Writer, and then it had Numeric and other things, but not the full suite. So I said yes, and then after the suite was installed, I then had Calc, Impress, Draw, Base. They were all added into the Office menu item. So that was good. I also was then prompted to install development packages. These are less commonly used packages like VCS, SSH, those kinds of things. I went ahead and installed that. I was asked if I wanted to install LampStack. So it kind of was moving up. Yeah. And then, of course, Apache Web Server, PHP, et cetera. I said no. And then the very last one was whether I wanted to install the Debian packaging tools. So, you know, clearly this distro is, while certainly somebody, a newbie could probably use it, it definitely has a target audience in mind. And I opted not to install that because I knew I wouldn't be using it. So. Anyway, but after these items were completed, I then proceeded to explore, BL2. The first thing I noticed is that there are several install submenus. In other words, when I right click the menu on the OpenBox, desktop, I had several little instances of install, and under those, for example, let's say graphics, there were individual options that existed to install programs such as GIMP, Blender, Inkscape, and I decided to install Inkscape. And so the procedure, once you do that, it then just checks for the internet connection, and you can kind of watch this, and then prompts for the password, and then it runs the apt-get toolset. To go ahead and install that. So yeah, so when you right click on it, you see these little installs, and then when you open it up, you've got a lot of options available to you. So that's kind of nice. It allows you then to further customize your system. Now after that install was complete, hitting any key will close that script window, and the installed script is now listed in the graphics main menu rather than under the install submenu there. So I appreciated the efficiency of this approach. It keeps the ISO small and allows the user to customize the install. As I just mentioned. Other install options for browsers in BL2 include Chromium, Chrome Stable, and my little all-time favorite, Opera. I also tested IceWeasel, but as you recall from earlier, IceWeasel is already installed as part of the defaults. By the way, too, Flash is disabled by default in IceWeasel, but for test purposes, I activated it and use it to listen to audio files. I had no problem with those. And then also no problem with YouTube either. YouTube doesn't use Flash. It uses, I think, what does it do now? HTML5?
Yeah, you use, I'll move to HTML5
yeah,
now.
So I was not expecting to have any problems with YouTube either way. I also want to spend some time discussing the configuration tools that BL2 includes in its preferences menu. Now, under preferences, you're going to see you'll see an open box submenu that will allow you to edit various configuration files, including the open box right-click menu. The project thoughtfully includes a menu item under open box, which, when open, describes how to update the right-click menu. Because when I first tried it, I didn't read the directions. Imagine that. And I was trying to add something here just to see if I could do it, and it didn't stick. So I went in and read the directions, and I'll be darned if it didn't work.
Hey.
Funny how that is. Am I the only one that doesn't read directions first?
Directions?
These directions.
Read what manual?
All right. I feel better already. Yeah, so I didn't RTM until later. And then I did, and it worked. So
read that fine manual.
Yeah, RTFM. Read that fine manual. But anyway, so, and then, let's see here. And then the Conky submenu, because remember I mentioned that it installs with a nice Conky display on the right side. The Conky submenu lets you select from over a dozen preset Conky layouts. I tested several, and they work perfectly. I had some Conky info across the top. Actually, you could install a bunch of it and have it all over the place. But I decided I had it on the right by default. Then I showed it across the top. I ended up with some stuff on the left. And again, this is all going into this menu and just selecting what you want to see. And Tony, I remember you were a big Conky fan. You had like this really tricked out Conky desktop.
Yeah, I was running that for a long time until when I reinstalled my laptop. I just pasting in the scripts back in place didn't do it. So I've got to go back and find the what package has to be installed to get it working right.
Okay.
That's what made me break it too. I used to have it and then something didn't work and I'm like, oh, well.
And then later never comes.
The one I had was really cool because it just overlaid on top of your desktop. It didn't give you like a black bar on the side or something, and it had a lot of really cool info.
Yeah, and that's what I think that's what this one did. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, it just showed you know your system info, how much resource you were using, how much RAM, and all that kind of stuff. And,
yeah.
And then various hotkeys or super keys.
Oh, nice.
Thanks again, Tom.
Super key.
Super key.
It's not the Windows key.
No, and I kind of knew that, too. Yeah. I just forgot.
I do have to get a little sticker to cover up the logo like you did.
Yeah. Oh, actually, Windows has never run on this.
What's that?
Windows has never run on this.
That's how I'm with my new computers as well. If I do buy a new one, I don't always, but I take the hard drive out and put it on the shelf, and I put an SSD in and load Linux. That way, when I'm done with it, usually people want Windows back on there. It's the untouched OS. I just stick the drive back in.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, anyway, but on with my, look at this. On with my fresh look. So let's see here. So if you want to customize Conky further, BL2 includes a Conky editor that lets you select the layout to edit. And then, is it Genie or Genie? I think it's Genie. G-E-A-N-Y, the little text editor. That's GTK. It's in GNOME and others. Anyway, it opens to the chosen Conky RC file. So you also have the option of editing more than one at once, so that if you want to take maybe something from this one, maybe the first file and add it to your second Conky file and then use that as your default, you can do that. So it was really kind of nice. Yeah, I was impressed with the configurability of the system from this angle. And then preferences also includes option for the Tint 2 panel app. So I ended up, not surprisingly, I ended up moving my Tint 2 panel to the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that, and that worked well. Now, I'm a fan of that throwback package manager Synaptic. And I'm happy to report that BL2 comes with Synaptic already installed. Now, the repositories by default are, of course, I added the dev multimedia, so that was there, but I went in and took a look. There's BunsenLabs.org / Debian is there, and then I use Nexus.net because it's local.
Oh, yeah.
to download my Debian updates and things. So that's in there. And then the security repository from Debian. And then the multimedia. So I had four of them there. I also test installed one program from Synaptic, Kaden Live.
Hey,
thought of you, Tom, when I did
package.
It.
It's a great package.
And it installed just fine. However, the icon to launch the app did not appear in the OpenBox menu, except for a menu item in... there was a menu item in what's called places, which are basically file locations, folder locations, for a Kaden Live folder in my home directory. Now, I did end up rebooting thinking that maybe something needed to be applied, but I actually never could find it. I ended up manually editing, and again, because I had the instructions, it was very easy to do. I just manually edited the menu, the right-click menu, and added Kaden Live as a clickable thing, and when I clicked it, it opened. So, I'm not sure if there was something there I was missing. Might be a little thing that the project might want to think about, but it just didn't work for me. But I was also using Alt+F2 and typing Kaden Live in the box. I was also able to launch it that way. So you can get there from here. It's just that the expressway appears to be closed for repairs or something. but anyway, so now there are also some other interesting programs that I found in BL2. And one of them is called Mandelbulber. That's sorry for the snort, but I just laughed when I read that. I just thought, God, that is just an attractive name, Mandelbulber. But what it is, it's an experimental application that helps to make rendering 3D Mandelbrot fractals much more accessible. Now, this little project is kind of cool, and I was fascinated by it, so I added it to my Google Plus stream, put it out there and posted it a few days ago. But it's available not only for Linux, but it's also available for Windows. There are some really complex graphics that you can create with it, as you can see there from...
I pulled it up their website, which is mandelbulber.com.
Yeah.
Lots of fractals.
Yeah, really some interesting
Very
stuff.
Very trippy.
And also it's available in FreeBSD via port. So it's been ported to FreeBSD, but it is,
pretty wild.
Pretty wild is right. But in looking at the interface to use it, because I did open it up, it looks like it's got a little bit of a learning curve, because there's all sorts of various, inputs you need to provide that will affect that, final product in, various ways. And I think you really have to have a bit of an understanding of how that's impacted.
Yeah.
It's math, I guess is what I'll just say.
Yeah,
one
There's of my friends,
involved.
I knew it sounded familiar. I have a friend who's, goes a little over the top with this. He's actually bought server time on render farms to render the sizes he wants because he prints them in large scale at full DPI.
Really?
So, when you don't have enough computers, you spend money on a render farm to design these because that's his hobby.
Yeah. just pay for what you use, I guess. Well, that can be helpful. So. I can see how how this program could be used to render backgrounds for games and different things. So
it's pretty slick.
Yeah. So anyway, that's again. I'll say that name one more time: Mandelbulber. It's German. All right. There was another one on there too. Have you guys heard of Catfish?
No. Okay. Real quick about the Bunsen. I like their logo with the flame referring to Bunsen burner, but I was hoping that Dr. Bunsen Honeydew from the Muppets would be their... That's who I think of when you say it. Sorry, Sesame Street messed me up.
Yeah.
Bunsen? Yeah, you mean Dr. Bunsen Honeydew.
Yeah. Right. anyway, but getting back to Catfish... Catfish is a file searching utility and it uses the search engines that are already at your disposal. So what it does, instead of creating, taking like a MySQL, index and building one after it scans your hard drive, what it does is it uses locate and, where is and those databases that already exist on the system. And, you just simply, I think it's the find and locate, databases. Yeah. So it then uses those. So.
Well, that should make it a little bit faster then.
Yeah, I didn't really play around too much with this, but I thought the concept was kind of nice and efficient rather than just, again, recreate the wheel, take advantage of the other wheels already there. So my rating, overall I was impressed with Bunsen Lab Linux. It's clean, efficient, and ready for prime time. I think anybody who liked CrunchBang and liked that kind of efficient desktop is going to like, Bunsen Lab Linux. So,
awesome.
Yeah. I was impressed with it. I really was. So.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So that's my fresh looks.
All right. Well, thank you, Mary.
Hey, you're welcome. You're welcome. So, anyway, we can talk about anything else we want to talk about? Any fresh looks on anything else?
You know, on my desktop, I'm going through and rebuilding some of the machines mm-hmm. I'm running for, like, my file server and my own cloud.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to build out VMs and just run them on my PC. And that way I only have one computer running for all the time instead of three different computers.
Oh, yeah.
So I was in the middle of doing my own cloud setup, and I have an SSL cert that's self-signed.
Mm-hmm.
So I just copied it over from the old computer to the new one, and
it bombed.
Yeah, Apache is bombing on me, like won't start. But when I turn off the SSL site, mm-hmm. you know, you do like sites enabled or sites available.
Mm-hmm.
When I turn it off, then it Apache starts with fine.
Did it take like a fingerprint or a footprint of the system that it was originally created on? Because you said you moved it.
Right.
And maybe no, it's not matching up?
That's possible, but I don't think so. I mean, certs should be able to be copied from one place to another because that's how, like, a CA, they create the cert and send it to you.
I guess one of the other questions is it giving permissions errors? Making sure that you have the readability set properly for it.
Oh, yeah.
I'll look into that.
Because if you set it, like, writable by others, it bombs.
Oh, yeah.
I've done this exact
really?
Thing.
Oh,
and
okay.
I learned how to break Apache in an interesting way.
Cool, yeah.
You clever guy.
Sometimes it's simple things like that I overlooked. So I did the same thing when I moved servers over and copied the cert over without creating a new one. Mm-hmm. Even though it's self-signed, I'm like, oh, I got one and everything yeah. accepted it. Let me just yeah. move it over.
Right.
Well, there. So try that and report back.
I will.
I've taken a more in-depth look at SyncThing. SyncThing replaces proprietary sync and cloud services with something open, trustworthy, and decentralized.
We talked a little bit about it because I started playing with it.
Oh, yeah.
I have an even fresher look.
So they have SyncThing Core, which is the command line interface which is all driven by web UI. So the default install on Linux, Windows, Mac, FreeBSD, Solaris, mm-hmm. you name it, they have a version for it. They all start with a standard CLI, and then you log into a web interface, localhost, and port number.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few different projects. This is what I had wanted the testing on. There's some GTK projects out there, so it gives it a nicer, cleaner interface to make things easier to do on both Windows and Linux to say, hey, check this box. It'll start on boot and things like that. There's ways to do it, of course, with the command line, but not everybody's really prepared to go in there and create an init script and add that to the startup.
Mm-hmm.
So they have some tools that make that a lot easier, which is kind of cool. I don't know why they're not directly available on the SyncThing site, but they link to them. So it's not surprised they're not rolled right into the project.
Mm-hmm.
But it works really well. It even has a phone app, and it has QR codes to scan. So they kind of copied Steve Gibson's squirrel idea. So, oh, you want to set it up on here? Just scan the QR code. It pulls it up through the web interface, and you scan it with your phone and can... I didn't use that feature, but it's kind of what it's for, which is kind of cool. But if you want a decentralized peer-to-peer peer-to-peer system, you can set up, if you want, one dedicated server that's on all the time and then share with all of your friends and sync it. Or you can just say, me, you, and we'll all just sync up, and whenever we're online, it'll figure it out. It does it both ways. The centralized server or decentralized also supports auto-discovery, granular permissions, granular folder permissions of who you share with. This solution may work for one of my clients that does not want to go for the cloud because of some issues they have. One, with bandwidth, and two, one of their big problems is they just create these massive files, so it would cost them a lot of money to go with a cloud syncing solution. They have terabytes of design files.
Oh, wow.
And so they're looking at this as a possible option. So when they take the laptop is in the building, it just syncs up with all the design computers. When they take it on site, it has the full database there all the time. Any changes they make will just be resynced to the internal share, and there's no cloud portion necessary for that.
That is pretty nice. Yeah, I can see that for small teams to do collaboration, that would be really nice. Like you're saying, the
Yeah. And if you're security conscious and you go, I don't know that I want Dropbox to have all of my files and a copy of everything or any of the file syncing companies, you're doing it completely internally. It's got its own security certificate. So all when you, even if you are passing across the open net, it is, in the, it's encapsulated security.
Very cool.
I'm sorry, Tom. I may have missed this. As far as some, if, let's say you're in location A and you're got a computer in location B and they're part of that system. How does it find it? I mean, it do you have to manually invoke something?
There's two different ways to do it. if you're running it internally in network, you're going to have to manually invoke and say, you'd say, okay, well, you use a web interface to discover the other nodes. But when you're outside, they actually offer a free auto discovery server. So you can actually have an announcer so you can just find the servers. And at that point, you're kind of announcing, but, and you can turn all that off. That way you can say manually only specify. But one of the ways you can do it with the phone, for example, is, if I add it to my phone, instead of using Google or some other service to sync all the photos as I take them on my phone, I load this on here and it syncs to my server in-house. And then you don't have to surrender any of your photos to a cloud service, but you still have that security and backup on your phone that you were looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, that really syncing the pictures and videos is the biggest thing that I use the phone app for. And I mean, I use OwnCloud and I do that, but sync thing is really nice.
Yeah, I kind of like that as a concept. And it's competing with OwnCloud in one way, but it's a different product. Because if you just have, you want to anonymously say, you know what, I got this folder of books, all open source, all licensed, I own the rights to all this stuff, but I'd like to share it with someone. You could actually do that and then give them links to it because it also supports read-only shares. Or if you like the person, you go, you know what, I'll post a read-write share because you want to be able to contribute to this.
And you can edit my books.
And you can, yeah, you can add to the files. And then you can turn on revisioning so it tells you who changed what when. And if they go and delete your books, all it does is move them to a different folder. So anything gets deleted moves over to a different folder. So they've got all these other options, or let's say you could create read-only group and then a subfolder that says write to this, and they can move things there. And if you want, you just drag them into the different folder and share back with the group. So definitely it's a different play. This came out of the concept for BT Sync, which is a torrenting protocol for this, and they never released the source code of how it worked. So they just said, well, then don't. We're going to create our own thing that does all the same thing with all the same features and all the same concepts, 100% open source. Because there's a scary thing about BT Sync, they were really trying to push it as a product, but without telling us any of the underlying technology.
And who was trying to do that? What was it, the company?
Who runs BT Sync? I'm trying to remember, the torrent people. Run it.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Yeah. To look up on our website. But nonetheless, it's a neat tool.
I, you know, and it's funny because I was thinking about that yesterday or day before, and I've got that on my plate to kind of move off Dropbox and do this myself. But the key thing is that, if I'm sitting here and I need access to something that's on a computer at home, how can I get to it without too much difficulty? I mean, here I just simply log into Dropbox, download my files, and I'm good.
And OwnCloud is still the solution I'm using. I don't know that I'm going to abandon OwnCloud. I like to have this as another tool in my toolbox, but I really am a big fan of OwnCloud and their interface and things like that.
Yeah.
I also like just to go on the OwnCloud web interface, which I don't use very often, but if I need to, I can just right-click on a file and say, show me all the past versions of this file and restore them.
Yeah.
I actually use that for my, because I don't think about it, I auto-save with my accounting updates for my accounting software, and I'm like, oh yeah, I want to demo something. So I just grabbed the previous version of it, downloaded it, and worked off a previous version file so I could re-show the import. Cause I already knew what the end result was, but I didn't record it on video, so I rolled backwards.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very cool.
One other quick thing I looked at, and this was really easy. Open Broadcast System. I was using Screen Record. I started using, Open Broadcast to record, my demos. Man, that's easy.
Is it?
Yeah. I was like intimidated because I tried another one and I was disappointed with like it had a lot of complexity. I don't remember the name of it because I abandoned it very quickly. I'm like, I like simple Screen Recorder. It's in the name. It's simple. I press record. It records which monitor and we go. Open Broadcast System. Just as nice. Cross platform Windows and Linux and Mac. And
right.
I think Black too, but real easy to record screencasting and things like that. Another cool thing to look at.
That's the same system that, what Door to Door Geek or PodNuts uses.
Exactly. Yes.
Yes,
great
you can
system.
Bring in multiple sources of video and audio and then have one stream out if you want to stream it out live.
Yep, you can stream it out live. And it also supports like rescaling and some other features. So it's really, it's a really nice system. It's awesome. Really easy to use. It's the interface is just click, choose video source, name it. Click, choose audio source, name it. Choose other audio source, name it. And that's it. And it's persistent. It remembers it, and you can save multiple configurations, which is kind of cool. If you can save like a gaming configuration where you want to pull these sources in, another configuration where you pour this source in. Just a really intuitive interface. Like, I didn't have to go watch a whole tutorial. I started playing with it and go, well, that was easy.
Right.
So definitely it's worth checking out if you're into doing screencasting and recording. It's a really easy way to do it. It's actually probably easier than a simple recording software that I'm using.
Hmm.
Very cool.
Excellent. Well, were you going to say something, Tony?
I was saying, I think we're at the end.
Oh.
Or did you have something else?
Well, the only thing I want to mention, just kind of circling back the whole cloud server discussion, one thing I should almost take a fresh look at was, Tom, you familiar with the Tonido plug server?
I am not.
Oh, okay. It uses Linux, and it was a little device. I've got one of these. Actually, I've got one that I've never used, and it's sitting in the box at home, and then I've got various external drives. And I'm just wondering if maybe I should put that thing in place, set it up so that I can access it, you know, through my home system. And if you go to tonidoplug.com, you can see you can download the software and everything. I think parts of it are open source. I'm not sure if the entire thing is, because I haven't really looked at it recently. But anyway, then they've got the Tonido WebShare Pro, which allows you to instantly share large documents and media files with your friends, family, colleagues, or anyone. that you've designated, I think is what they want to say there, without time-consuming uploads or emails. So it's all off this little server box. So I can't believe I knew something that you didn't know.
You caught me off guard.
Oh, my God. But anyway, that'll be the only time, I'm sure. But anyway, again, I've got the thing sitting there, and I should really fire it up, see if that would work. Yeah. I think the fear that I have, and fear is not the right word, but the anxiety that I have is that I then am responsible for maintaining that thing, and if it crashes or my internet goes down, I don't have access to the servers.
Yeah.
You know, or info on it.
If I take myself out of the fact that I have servers, I have a rack and everything in my office, it would make OwnCloud a little bit more daunting because where do I put it all? You know, so it's it's a hard to recommend for a bare bones consumer product unless you have some infrastructure behind you. But OwnCloud offers their own hosting services and you're still entrusting it to them, but you know, they're open source at least.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, that's the only thing I wanted to mention.
All right. Well, I think we're coming to the end. So you've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This was episode 167.
That's right. Fresh looks, Bunsen Lab Linux.
All right. This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
And Tom Lawrence.
We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.
Hi, folks. This is Chatter. K. Wisher, Honky Magoo, 5150, and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script, and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Linux Luddites is a show where we try out all the latest free and open source software and then decide we like the old stuff better.
More than just news and releases, we check out a wide range of Linux distros, cover your feedback, talk about obscure command line programs, discuss burning issues over a pint, and much, much more. So join me, Paddy,
and me, Joe, every 2 weeks for news, reviews, comment, and generally being grumpy at LinuxLuddites.com.
Linux Luddites, because not all change is progress.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit lhspodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.
The Linux Link Tech Show, live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast. On the web, www.tllts.org. By email, techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC channel, thelinuxlink.net, port 6667/techshow. And Flying Rich is so hot.